Okay, good evening, welcome. My name is Rhea Stevens. I'm Policy Projects and External Affairs Manager at the IWA, and it's my pleasure to invite you to this debate this evening. Auriel Miller introduces these sessions. Unfortunately, she's not able to join us this evening due to a sudden family bereavement. And so it is my pleasure to welcome you here for what promises to be a really fascinating and particularly timely evening of debate. A few items of housekeeping, so we're not expecting any fire alarms. If you hear a fire alarm, the exits are both to the left and to the right of these doors, and please make your way to the main entrance. Can I ask you to please turn your phone sounds off? But you're very welcome to join the debate, as well as in the room, on Twitter using the hashtag IWADebate. So turning to thank yous, firstly, I'd like to say thank yous to our sponsors and partners in this debate series, Cardiff University. Also to Evershed Sutherland for hosting us in this office and giving us somewhere warm and comfortable with refreshments on what is a particularly grim and cold evening. And finally, I want to say thank you to our speakers and to our chair for joining us and loaning us their expertise to inform this debate. And like I said, it's extraordinarily timely. So just a few weeks ago, the long-awaited parliamentary review, chaired by Dr. Ruth Hussey, reported and provided recommendations on the way forward for the NHS in Wales, particularly focusing on its future sustainability. During January, we had the most recent nationwide IT failure, affecting the whole of the health service. So not one, but two systems simultaneously failed, leaving the health service and its staff to perform some of even the most basic functions. The health service in Wales takes up 50% of the Welsh government's budget, but there are persistent concerns and varied concerns raised regularly about the quality of provision. And crucially, the impact that provision has on the health of the Welsh population. Today, the Health Secretary, Vaughan Gething, called for an urgent transformation. He also called for a grown-up debate that includes politicians, staff, and the public in agreeing the way forward. What I thought was particularly pertinent about Vaughan Gething's statement today is that acknowledgement that many of the blocks to reform are politics, actually, and public opinion. And these are often some of the most challenging things to overcome. We often have a good idea of what the solutions may be, but lack the consensus in order to be able to deliver on them. So in that spirit of exploration, a grown-up debate, and hopefully some consensus on building the way forward and the actions that we can agree to, it's my pleasure to hand you over to Marcus Longley, who's chair of the Cwmtaf Health Board and also chair of the IWA's Health and Social Care Policy Group. Thank you.
Rhea, thank you very much. can everybody hear me? That's not because of some magic projection of my voice, it's because of a little thing here. Thank you, and it's a huge pleasure, I think, for all of us to be here this evening. Let me just explain what it is we're intending to do. So in a minute, I'm going to invite my colleagues just to tell us who they are and in 2 minutes get across the handful of key issues that they want to bring to the table this evening. So at that stage, they're simply laying out their stall. They're not trying to defend or justify what they're saying. And then the panel will have a bit of a discussion and we'll pick up on some of those themes and people will have a little bit more time to explain and argue and we'll see how much consensus and how much disagreement there is amongst ourselves. And then we'll open it up for everybody to join in before we finish and go and have a glass of wine. So that's our intention. I hope that meets with your expectations. So there will be an opportunity for you to have your say, but you've got to listen to us first. So, with that in mind, let me start then with the lady on my right, Kerry Bailey. Kerry, who are you and what do you believe?
Thank you. I'm Dr. Kerry Bailey. I'm a GP 2 days a week. I'm also qualified as a public health consultant, but my main job currently is working for a health tech company in Swansea. I also want to lay claim to being a patient in that 6 months ago I was diagnosed with cancer, So I've had several operations and daily chemo and radiotherapy over a couple of months. My values and how I think we're going to balance technology and the tender touch are really based in what I believe in healthcare anyway. I don't think there's any difference between health tech and other forms of aspects of healthcare. So first of all, we have to be patient-centered. So not health tech for the sake of it, but based on the patient. And I say that because I've been to health tech conferences in San Francisco, but also even here in Wales, when it's about bits of kit rather than thinking about why are we doing this and who is the patient. And as part of that, we need to constantly think about decreasing inequalities. All health technology should be evaluated, but just as any service change is, or any change to our practice, we need to think about how are we evaluating it, both from the patient perspective and data. And I'm very passionate about data-driven decisions and using the data we have available to improve the services we have. And finally, implementation. There are some excellent innovations in health tech in Wales which aren't being implemented. And so I hope we can come today to some agreement about how in Wales we can use our resources in a way to really improve healthcare through technology.
Super, thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll come back to many of those themes in a little bit. Second, Rachel.
So I'm Rachel Rahman. I'm the director of the Centre for Excellence in Rural Health Research at Aberystwyth University. But I'm based in the psychology department there, so my interest in this is that my main research area of interest is in terms of both patient acceptability and experiences of using certain technologies in their healthcare services, but also the potential barriers and benefits that healthcare professionals see in terms of implementing that into service. I suppose my key points that maybe I'll focus on today are in part to think about this idea that actually if managed appropriately, technology doesn't need to be to the detriment of a human touch. Certainly when you think of that in terms of building effective relationships, effective communication between healthcare professionals and their patients, when managed appropriately, that doesn't necessarily need to be an either or. But also to think about this idea that all too often I think technology in health and social care has been thought of in terms of prudent healthcare and a way of saving money. And certainly from a rural health perspective, I think quite often it isn't necessarily going to be a saving exercise, but actually it has huge benefits in terms of helping the equality of access to services for rural patients, for minimising quite stressful travel and organisation that there might be for them in terms of accessing services that they might not otherwise have. But I also think we need to be realistic in terms of rolling this out in terms of some of the key challenges that face healthcare professionals in terms of managing these kinds of service deliveries.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rachel. That's great. And then Mike.
Hello. I'm used to belting out my voice because I'm used to not having microphones. I'll try and talk at the level of trust the technology. Trusting the technology, that's always a dangerous thing to do. I'm an early adopter. I love early adopting. I love jumping into technology and trying them out. And the main reason for that is that so that you don't have to. Because often as not, techno fixes, Kerry referred to earlier, the idea of technology being, solution being thrown up trying to find a problem is a huge issue. And the fallacious view that technology will save money is a very common thing. Often what those systems aren't doing when they try and introduce computer systems or technology systems is they're undervaluing or not even valuing at all the human element to these things. So I'm what a colleague described as a very strange mix of the very, very new and the very, very old. And I think that even though I am an early adopter, I think you should only adopt as much technology as you can get away with and no more than that. So I think my main point for tonight, my main viewpoints here are technology is wonderful, gives lots of opportunities, but it's also potential for misuse and abuse. and we have to be very, very cautious about not valuing the human side of these things. Having said that, I think the idea of putting on an artificial continuum, the idea of technology at one end and the tender touch at the other, I think in reference to Rachel's point, is that they aren't incompatible. Technology has often evolved as just another medium of communication, a tool for people to link together. And I think Rachel and I, in that respect, may have a lot of commonality in that technology as an enabler to keep people in touch is actually a wonderful thing. It's when it gets in the way of that or replaces that and undervalues the human side of things that we are potentially at risk in future.
Excellent. You notice he was actually timing himself there, which is, as from a chair's perspective, that's an absolute delight.
So technology.
So I'm disappointingly, I'm going to have my say as well, because I was booked tonight as a panelist, and I'm only agreed to chair it if I could have my say as well. So I'm afraid you're going to have to listen to my 2 minutes worth too. So Marcus Longley. And I'm currently chair of a health board. A couple of things I want to get across this evening, and I think it's about the dysfunctional way in which the health service handles technology. And let me just give you three facts which I still can't get my head around. So, you know, most organisations like the health service would reckon that they should spend about 4% per annum on information technologies in particular. And the health service in Wales spends less than 2% and has done for a long time. So chronic underinvestment is the first point. Second point, I think, is the fact that, as colleagues have already said, in healthcare, unusually, the introduction of technology very rarely saves money. There are very few efficiency gains measured in those terms as a result of introducing technology into healthcare. It is unlike almost any other sector of the economy. And that is a fundamental problem, I think, when you link it particularly with that 2% issue. The third point I want to make is how there is an enormous paradox, I think, probably implicit actually in those two things. So technology, information technology in particular, has got an enormous amount to add to every domain that matters within healthcare, to the patient's experience, to the efficiency of care, to the safety of patients, and also to the effectiveness of care. So technology is fundamental in each of those four areas, the four things really that matter most in terms of the future sustainability of healthcare. And yet in Wales, we are abysmally slow at introducing the technology, and our approach is frustratingly piecemeal. You've only to read the recent report from the Wales Audit Office, for example, to see those problems catalogued. So for me, there is a fundamental and perplexing paradox here. Given the huge potential of these technologies, why the hell are we so poor at adopting them? There we are, my soapbox. I should have actually said at the beginning, I'm not speaking as the chair of Cwmtaf Health Board. It would be appalling if I were quoted as such, having said any of those things. So this is just me spouting off. So we're going to have a little bit of a discussion now, and hopefully there'll be a chance for people to elaborate a little bit on what they've said so far. So maybe if we start with the potential. So why is technology so important? What's it good for? What should we be embracing it? What should we be expecting from technology? Can you encapsulate that? Kerry, what are you looking for?
Well, that's a very broad question. Perhaps I'll answer it by just giving an example from my experience. So as a GP, I sit there, and apart from obviously doing all the caring, I put in lots of information, data, into the computer. With my other hat on, I was being a public health consultant and asked to redesign services. And I knew in order to redesign those services and to evaluate them and to know where to spend the limited resources, I needed to have some of that data. And yet the connection wasn't there. I couldn't use that data. The example in that case was diabetes prevention. You know, 10% of the NHS budget is spent on diabetes, yet 90% of it is preventable. And we know how to prevent it through weight management and other things. So it makes absolute sense to use that data, and yet we don't. So about 4 years ago, I started a project with ABMU and SAIL, and we were given SBRI money, so about £500,000 or something, to develop this wonderful system, which predicts for ABMU, but it would apply to the whole of Wales, not only how much diabetes there'll be over the next year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, what the cost will be, where it would be, in which age groups, in which geographies, down to LSOA, what if you put in weight management in certain places or other interventions, how much money it would save, but more importantly, how many deaths you'll prevent, how many strokes you'll prevent, how many heart attacks, how many amputations, etc. You get the idea. We did all of this. It's usable. ABMU loved it. Great. Now, to me, we've answered that question. It's been funded. We can use that. But we don't. The NHS had a free license to use it, so it wasn't cost. It was culture. It was adopting those new innovations. We also did it for unscheduled care. These unpredictable winter pressures. Actually, there are lots of models for putting in temperature, flu rates. We did it. They're not that unpredictable, actually. They're quite predictable. You have to put resources in. You have to plan. So does that answer your question? There is potential there, and we can be doing that.
So that's about using intelligence intelligently then, really, and the technology can enable much better decisions to be made if only we were to use it and the data that's currently available. Hmm. And just in terms of jargon, in case people don't know, ABMU?
Abertawe, Brome and Gamwig, so Swansea, Neath but Albert and Bridgend Health Board.
And SAIL?
Is a secure, anonymised interbank. Basically, it's lots and lots of data from across Wales, primary care, secondary care. It's a fantastic research resource. What it is not is something that we can currently use to plan and evaluate services. And we have the technology there, we have the governance there, we do not have something that allows us to do that. So we are still in a position that I was in 5 years ago, whereas if I wanted to plan diabetes prevention services in Wales, despite having the data, despite having the technology, despite having the algorithms, I would still have to go, I'm putting it there and there and there.
Brilliant, that's great. So Rachel, your take on all this is probably slightly different from that. So you've done a lot of work, as you've said already, around rural populations and almost the public interface and professional interface with technologies.
Yeah. So
what do you want? What is technology for? What's the great dividend that we need to get out of it?
I think the main thing that we see from our research is the huge psychological benefits that patients get from using it. And I'll be honest, I was somewhat of an advocate for technology, but a little bit suspicious of it. And even I was shocked at the kinds of benefits that patients spoke about in terms of using it. So the kinds of things that I thought that I was expecting to see were things around the reassurance it gave them. If they had either a piece of telemonitoring kit at home that gave them feedback, or if they had a laptop where they could VC link back to their palliative care team, for example, having that ability to contact in from home gave them a huge amount of reassurance. And actually, they didn't use it a huge amount, but just knowing it was there was quite a reassuring type of thing. I expected to see that. A lot of people talked about minimizing the stressful travel that they had in rural areas. So rather than having to travel, which can be up to an hour to get to the local hospital in the case of Aberystwyth, they would be able to connect in, and they talked about the psychological benefits of not being stressed about who was going to take time off work to take them. Were they going to be able to park when they got there? So they'd leave early to make sure they could park. They'd then spend 10 minutes probably in a quick consultation before they had that hour-long drive back. That was their whole day gone. The next day they were exhausted. So when they used the technology, they spoke about actually feeling quite liberated in terms of their day. Suddenly they had their day in front of them to do whatever they wanted. But what I wasn't expecting to see was things around the increased empowerment linking to the team gave them when they were in their own homes. And actually talking about this idea of I invited them into my space. I wasn't going to the hospital into a waiting room. They were coming into my home. And that gave them far more confidence to ask questions. They'd written notes ahead of the meeting about what they wanted to get out of that consultation. They weren't as stressed when they were in it. They talked about not feeling conscious of a waiting room of people sitting there waiting to come in after them, so they didn't feel quite as rushed. So from a patient perspective, I think actually for rural patients, there are huge benefits in terms of being able to feel less isolated and more connected to their healthcare professionals. But I think actually some of the things we saw has benefits for the vast majority of the general public. If we're talking about better quality of communication with people at certain times, then I think actually there's huge potential that we haven't explored yet.
So that's technology not just facilitating the current model of care, but actually changing it qualitatively in some quite significant ways.
Absolutely.
And what's in it for the professional?
Well, long term, I think that what they would be hoping is that actually, if you think about the healthcare professional in that situation, somewhere like Aberystwyth, nurses would potentially be driving an hour, hour and a half, seeing one patient, and that would be their morning's work. This way, they were actually able to connect in, see four or five patients of a morning. Not to say they wouldn't call and see some of them. If they were concerned, they would still drive and make that visit, but they were much better able to prioritise who they were seeing. They were able to check in on more people who probably they wouldn't have been seen because they had to prioritise the more at-risk patients. So I think they saw huge benefits in terms of their ability to manage their workload.
Great, thank you. Mike, so from your perspective, what's the big dividend? What's the big promise here?
Okay, I just realised earlier when I introduced myself, I kind of gave a lot about my position rather than who I was and why you should maybe listen to me. I've been working with technology for 30 years. I predicted the internet before the internet. And I've been very, very cautious in making sure that there's always an evidence base for something being used. I'm a former school teacher, and obviously technology in learning, that most universities have a learning technology group now, which are focused at trying to get those Luddite lecturers to go into technology. And often it's without that idea of it, the real value of it. So my perspective in all the work that I do is to have evidence base. I mean, I've worked with computer games primarily and virtual reality. We did some computer games with EU funding a few years ago to help children with dyslexia to learn English as a second language. And they were games that were adaptable by the teachers and their parents and so on. And that was the vast majority of that EU-funded project was actually evaluation with teachers, with psychologists, and the technology development was actually a very small part. Similarly, just recently, we're currently working on a Road Safety Trust virtual reality app using tablets that are available in every school, a free app that's going to be available to all children in Wales and actually the whole of the UK, to teach them road safety, where they can actually use the technology. And unlike VR, where it's a headset, where they're enclosed and away, it's actually tablet-based, so that two or three can share it and work together, and there's no isolation. But the vast majority of that is about evaluating it with psychologists, tracking what they're doing to provide an evidence base that there is efficacy of the technology. And just recently, I've been asked to do some consultancy on a cognitive neurology game for older people to assess, are they starting to lose their faculties? And that's very interesting. So games and simulation, virtual reality, I mean, there's numerous examples. Surgeons have been using virtual reality and computer games to help their performance, and that's a measurable improvement in their performance in surgery. Virtual reality has been used as pain management, even during surgery and so on, almost sometimes more effective than traditional pain relief methods. So there's a lot of opportunities in simulation, in virtual reality, in game playing to engage and interest those people taking part. The kind of dark side of it is what Kerry was saying about big data. Well, you heard the term big data, is this idea of analytics, actually using all this information. And in some cases, it's not using it at all. In others, it's having algorithms that are racist or algorithms that are poor. In America, in the judicial system, they have an artificial intelligence that's supposed to predict what is the best penalty to give to someone to incarcerate them. And yet the data it was coming from wasn't saying black people give them worse sentences. It was saying people in poor areas, people with poor education. And you think, well, hang on a minute, that is black people. So although the algorithm wasn't particularly racist, it ended up effectively being racist. And there's numerous examples of artificial intelligence learning the wrong thing. But an area that I don't think we've particularly covered yet, just to finish off, is security. One of the great things about having all these different separate systems all communicating, so I don't have my medical file being this big and loads of paper, and when the hospital needs it, they have to ask my GP to send it off. At one point, they thought I'd been discharged from the local surgery because the hospital had kept it so long, they had just assumed I'd gone to another GP. And eventually it kind of came back and they were like, what are you doing here again? We shouldn't have that kind of system. These things should all be hooked up and connected. However, the downside of that, of course, is security. As soon as there's a lot of interconnections, we run the risk of the whole service going down because of a virus or ransomware switching off everyone's computers. Recently, I mean, the speaker earlier mentioned just recently the whole of the UK went down. But before that, last year, there was an attack. But NWIS, who are the IT suppliers for Wales, had upgraded a lot of computers. And that at that point, Wales was actually immune from a lot of the problems because they were taking security, you know, in a positive way. So security is, I think, an area which we need to consider too.
Thank you, Mike. That's great. So let's just look on the dark side a little bit then, Kerry. So you were very positive about, when you were talking before, about what information technology can do to us. Do you have any, or for us, sorry.
No, you might be right. Yeah.
Is there a downside that we should be worried about?
As we've heard, of course, that those are two good examples. One, potentially about security. And privacy, which are slightly different things. And what I've done over the last few years has been exploring with a variety of people their thoughts about this. So, you know, I'll sit in the Rhondda Valley and talk to groups of patients or, you know, groups of people in day centres about what their views on it are. Because I don't want to just come from, you know, early adopters type and impose my beliefs. And what they were saying to me was that, well, there's lots of big companies have lots more data than what you've got. You know, they're aware of what Facebook has and everything else, and the fact that now every time they go in, actually loads of their data is being shared and all the potential for that. And they thought that not to be using it, not to improve healthcare in general, anonymized data for improvement in healthcare, but also when they go to the hospital, the data, you know, the hospital not and them having to tell everybody everything again. You know, we hear that time and time again. We all experience it. Everybody you go to, you have to go through everything again. It's not good for the patient. And so they recognize there are risks. Of course there are. But they see the benefits as being far greater. And so that's one thing. And the second thing about the algorithms is in our firm, we have statisticians, we have data scientists, and they're applied statisticians. Yes, of course we use AI, and we do use some machine learning, but we use good old-fashioned stats. So it doesn't matter if it's small data or big data. Rubbish in, rubbish out. There are rules about stats. You know, you look at what the coverage is, you look at the biases. You know, that's what we do for a living. And unfortunately, I don't think there's a knowledge, perhaps generally, about what is good stats and what can, you know, have intrinsic biases, as you say, and lead to... You know, the example a few years ago was Google brought out a flu prediction model. Yeah. And for the first 2 or 3 years, worked beautifully. And then it wasn't a good algorithm. It just went completely off and was predicting, you know, twice as many or half as many. And actually the good old-fashioned communicable disease one, which was much simpler, had about, you know, 7 or 8 different aspects to it, was much more effective. So, yeah. So, as you say, it's the old and the new combined.
And what did the people you spoke to then, Rachel, what was their perspective on risks? And also, is there a generational thing? You know, people quite often say, don't they, that the younger generation share everything. Mm. They have a very different attitude towards what's private and what isn't.
Mm. Interestingly, age really didn't come out as a a predictor, well, not that we were statistically predicting, but it certainly you weren't able to determine people who take up technology or not, or their particular views on it. Similar to Kerry, I think most people we spoke to were of the opinion of, look, you know, if they're that interested in me, let them find out. There's nothing that I need to be that secure about my health. If it's going to improve the health system for me, who's really that interested, was the opinions that they tended to come out with. Not that that was a key focus of our questions, I'll point out. So we didn't systematically ask that.
But there wasn't much of a downside, basically, is what you're saying.
No, the key downside came more so from some of the monitoring systems than the video conferencing systems. So monitoring systems where there wasn't necessarily a face to put to the system. Again, most of the feedback of that was generally really positive, but there were anomalies where something hadn't quite worked, and usually that was where there was a mismatch between what the technology was doing and what they were accessing from their face-to-face care. So either the face-to-face team made it very apparent that they weren't approving of the technology, or they didn't see the point of it, and then there was a real, well, what's the point of this? If my healthcare team aren't making use of it, what's the point of me plugging in these numbers? Again, sometimes where there was automated feedback coming back to people, that had huge benefits for people learning about their conditions and actually developing much better self-management strategies. But for the odd person who didn't quite fit the traditional pattern, when that feedback was coming and they knew that actually that wasn't the appropriate advice, it was at those points that they started to lose faith in the technology. But they were quite savvy at knowing that. So it wasn't that people were just blindly going along with what the technology was telling them. So they were quite happy to use it whilst it was fitting in with what they felt was appropriate. But they were also quite sensible about understanding when there were a glitch in the system or when the feedback wasn't appropriate.
Let me just ask you then, we've said what other people think. But you know, we've all probably been patients, we've all been users of this technology. I mean, are people just hopelessly naive about the risks? Are you as relaxed about the risks as an end user, as it were, as most of the public seem to be? Would you trust it?
Yes. and I think that, you know, there's the anonymized data aspect, which is never truly anonymized, and I'm sure you're aware of this. It's de-identified. You take away date of birth and name and you know key identifiers. But actually, the example I used to work in Cornwall, and we had a lady from Oxfordshire who gave birth in our hospital, who it was Cameron. Mrs. Cameron, you know, you only need to know two or three facts about somebody.
Now you do.
It was in the news, you know. So it's quite easy to identify people if you know two or three. But it is illegal. You know, that's the other thing. If you've got anonymised data and you try to re-identify somebody, that's illegal. So it's not like people are going to take that data and be trying. And actually, you know what data's like? You know, it's just big reams of, yeah. So I think I would agree that if anybody wanted to go to all that difficulty to try and find somebody else about me, then... So there's that aspect of the anonymised data. I know I've talked to professionals and patients and lots of different groups of people, and I think it's not unanimous, because you do have some people who strongly disagree with it, but the vast majority of people think, yes, the benefits outweigh the risks, and I agree. And as for the going into hospital, everybody you see asks you, yes, they need to check who you are and your name and everything like that, but then your telephone number again, they write it down again, and you know... And what's your history again, and what medication you are, you know, and it happens all the time to everybody. And the other area that we haven't touched on, I'm doing a piece of work on DNAs, did not attend. If you're going for a lot of appointments, you get a lot of letters, paper letters. You get letters on the same day saying this is your new one, this is the one that's cancelled. You know, I lose track of what my appointments are. And when I talk to patients in Cwmtaf, and they're telling me that they tell the hospital, oh, I've got a carer who has to get me out, so it can't be too, get me out of bed and get me ready, so it can't be too early. Oh, I've got to get two buses if I go to that hospital, so, you know, it needs to be at a certain time. And the appointment comes and it's at 9 o'clock. Now, there are systems that have been around for about 5 years, proven, evaluated, acceptable, effective, where, you know, tried out in England, that are not being used in Wales, where people could still choose to have letters if they want, or they could get a telephone call or an SMS or an email. They could go on the system, they could choose their appointment, or they could not, or they can have it allocated, but they can put rules in. You know, it's another example of, you know, what do we have to do as a culture to say, how do we adapt? The patients are identifying this as an issue. The health boards are identifying it's an issue because too many DNAs. In psychiatry, there's 24 appointments people don't turn up to in CUMTAF. The technology exists. What do we have to do to push that along?
We'll come back to that question in a minute. But I still think there are risks here, aren't there? I mean, are we not being a bit naive about all this?
Yes. No, we are. And we're being naive in two ways. I think one of the biggest issues, there's kind of three risks to a technology being adopted, and that's confidence, competence, and commitment. So in the example you gave, when the team were saying, oh, you know, then the person would think, oh, I think so. And that's the idea of commitment to it. The idea of confidence is trust. If you want a really good example of how technology can either really click or really jar, there's a lovely BBC programme, it's a two-part programme called Six Robots and Us. It was on around about Christmas. If you get it on iPlayer, you should just about be able to watch it. And one of those was an autistic boy with a little robot that was supposed to help him to communicate. And there's lots of evidence of robots being used or robot toys being used to help autistic children communicate. When it didn't work, when it didn't identify, there was that disjunction. And it's that issue of trust. And that happened on a number of those examples in that Six Robots and Us program, all of which were related in some way to health. So it's very, very relevant to the audience here and to the debate. And it was when it didn't work that they lost faith. And that's the idea of confidence. If you don't have confidence, you won't engage in it. And then competence. And I think that's underlying why maybe the Welsh Health Service is a little bit behind. And it's speculation on my part. But the idea of competence is if you have all these systems in place but you don't feel competent to use them, you will resist it. You know, the difference here, people use the term Luddite all the time. Luddites were trying to protect their jobs. And that's why they engaged in violent acts. They saw that as a threat. Now, I wouldn't say it's quite as severe now, but people use the term Luddite all the time in the same way they use grammar Nazi and various other phrases, which are a little bit emotive. But I think people do sometimes think that the job is at risk, or they think that their competence is going to be questioned, that they won't know how to use it. And that's where, when you introduce technology, I mean, where Rachel's system has gone down really well is the technology was used for two people to communicate with each other. And therefore, any of the issues of competence kind of like go into the background. The confidence is there because, okay, it'll be a bit glitchy or it might go out a little bit. You might have to ask them to say something again if the connection's not great. But you'll overcome that because we're used to that with telephone calls and so on. But it's still ultimately something that they feel very confident about. It's communicating with a human. If it was a robot on the other end, wow, would that be different? And that's this issue, as I said, commitment, making sure you really commit to it, confidence, and trust as part of that, and then competence and training people where they need it.
That's really interesting. Let's come on then to this question about why are we so slow? Why are we so poor at this? I mean, that's my contention. Maybe that's not true. But Rachel, you've got quite an insight, haven't you, into some of the obstacles.
I have sympathy for healthcare professionals here because I'm getting a little bit fed up of hearing this idea of, oh, they're just reluctant to change and it's just barriers to change. But actually you look at the infrastructure we have in rural Mid Wales and you talk about confidence in the system, we can't access the people who need it the most. They don't have broadband. If they have internet at all, it's completely unreliable. So when you're setting up these systems that are meant to be, you know, you can have the best faith in the world in them. But if you're the clinician or the healthcare professional sat on the other side of that screen and a vulnerable patient's the other side and you cannot connect to them,
I'm sure there is no worse feeling in the world than that. And so we have to try and think about this, and granted it happened. I think they heard me say this the last bit, because suddenly we have super fast broadband in our village. We're okay now, thanks. But I think that, you know, we really need to think about how behind we are in rural areas of Wales in terms of rolling that out. The other thing I'd say is that I think the tech support within the NHS is really lacking. And I think in terms of, certainly the feedback we've had from healthcare professionals is they're fine if your computer, if your desktop computer goes down, but you say the words telehealth or telemedicine and they're not interested. So there's no designated person there to help set up the clinic, there to check that the connection's going to work. And when you're a busy clinician with a waiting room of people and you're sitting there faffing about trying to work out why some broadband connection hasn't worked, suddenly that thing that's supposed to make connecting to Mrs. Jones easier is a real headache. And for you, bringing her into the surgery or bringing her into an appointment, despite the fact she's had to travel an hour and a half to get there, I think my travel times are increasing every time I say it, but it's a real problem, I think, in terms of the confidence of healthcare professionals to rely on the systems and roll them out.
I think those travel times are realistic. I remember talking to somebody who travelled from north of Aberystwyth to their appointment in Neath.
Oh, yeah.
And she said we got there, we were with the doctor for about 10 minutes and we were on the road for, I think, something like five and a half hours or something. Right. I mean, that's maybe an extreme example. But let me just push you a little bit, though. You were very kind to the staff and you pointed to all the infrastructure problems and so on. Mm. But is there a bit of a sort of, you know, dog in the manger attitude? You know, I'd have to rearrange my clinics if I took this new technology on, you know, I'm sold that.
Certainly, I think there are two, again, I've got two points to make on that. One, yes, in terms of the way clinics are set up for clinicians. If you're going to run a telemedicine clinic, there's no actual system for that to be in place. It's added on to your usual workload of a day. Whereas actually, in the same way as you might, you know, organise an inpatient clinic or an outpatient clinic, there's no real reason why there couldn't be a telemedicine clinic for designated people. And I think that would make it easier for clinicians to see it as an encompassing part of their role. I think we're reliant on urban specialist centres often to be the linchpin or the linkpin back. And actually, for them, they don't always appreciate the benefits to a patient in Aberystwyth having to travel. So often there's a reluctance to find the specialists who are willing to connect back to rural hospitals. And I've forgotten my third point.
Can I just answer as a clinician?
Yes.
So I've got a couple of thoughts around this. First of all, it goes back to the whole old secondary care, primary care thing. Next time you're in your GPs, have a look at what technology is there. I worked a number of surgeries. We have a computer, yeah? And in fact, GPs were completely paperless. Well, secondary care still isn't. We were paperless in about 2000 or something, you know, very early. I have an automatic blood pressure thing now. My most advanced technology really is the telephone. The practice I was working in formerly a few months ago, we didn't do any telephone consultations. I thought it was ridiculous, but you know, I wasn't a partner. That's their decision. You know, why not? We now have, I have 25 minute appointments at the beginning of my clinic and again in the afternoon, and then I see face to face. Yeah, there's a bit of reorganisation there. And telephone, that's not modern technology, but actually patients, you know, it's better communication if it is something that you can sort out quickly. Otherwise, you know, you can still bring in, and that's in addition to home visits and everything else. And yes, it'd be lovely to have as much. I said, well, can't we just do face-to-face? You know, we've been, you know, the 8-year-olds and the 8-year-olds use FaceTime and Skype, and they have done for, you know, 12, 15 years now. But so even the telephone, we're having difficulty introducing.
So, Kerry, why then? Why do you like this?
Well, I'm going back to the primary care, secondary care conundrum. Next time you're in an operating theatre or almost anywhere, have a look at the tech. And there is so much technology. And I'm not sure the same evaluation and thought through process, everything goes into, you know, what do we introduce. But there's also, why are we like this? We're busy. You know, it's easier just to keep on the hamster wheel, isn't it? And it's good enough. And, you know, to if it's not easy for us to adopt because it's on our laptop or it's on in front of us and it's, you know.
But that still doesn't really explain it, does it?
I've remembered, you know, my point.
But I can't see, you know, the manager of Tesco's being allowed to say, "Ooh, I don't like these self-scanning checkouts. I'm not going to do them because I'd rather not."
Right.
But he wouldn't be allowed to say that, would
he? Okay. So a while ago, the BBC asked me to make commentary on a couple of stories, one of which was automation, because there was a business organisation that released analysis of, is automation a threat to jobs and so on. And then later on, there was a similar report that I commented on about technology used for helping older people. And there was actually a lot of commonalities in that debate. And at the end of the day, I'm sorry, it was a little bit cynical of me, but if the on-paper cost appears cheaper to have a computer technology solution, irrespective of the value add, which is why I mentioned earlier about not underestimating the value of people in the system, inevitably, you will automate. And those checkouts, everyone hates those self-service checkouts. Unexpected item in the bagging area is probably going to like be tattooed on my forehead when I eventually die. I'll be this unexpected item in the cemetery. And it's like the frustration you get, sometimes I'll go, right, I am going to wait 10 minutes to have a person today. And then other times I'm thinking, like, okay, I'm going to accept it's going to be a pain in the arse, and I'm going to just use this system because the queues are too big. So there's times when you kind of feel you have to use that technology. But the head of Tesco's is putting it in because he thinks that one person supervising 8 of these self-service systems is going to be cheaper. And as far as he's concerned, it is, but it's at our expense. Our expense in terms of frustration, in terms of time, and it's also a lot of people out of work who then aren't contributing to the economy. There's all sorts of knock-on. What appears to be cheaper isn't always the same. I mean, you said yourself, a lot of the IT that's been introduced into the healthcare system in Wales ends up, do you remember the paperless office? Yeah? I mean, look at it. It's more paper now than ever. You know, I think the IT was introduced. Well, who developed some of the early IT? Xerox PARC, yes. A photocopier company. But technology, if it's introduced to cut costs, if it's introduced to streamline, if it's introduced in a way that doesn't, in the initial design concept, make that link between what should be done by humans, what could be done by a hybrid, where one supports the other, and what can be done completely by computers. And often people don't have that debate of where does the human and the computer line get drawn. And when that's wrong, one way or the other, that's when we have problems.
Great. Rachel, have you remembered your third
yes.
thing? Marvellous.
I think it was going back to your idea about, well, are there some people who are resistant to it? And fundamentally, I think what's come out of our data is that the reason people go into the medical profession is because they like people and they want to help people and they enjoy forming that connection with somebody that makes them feel good because they're doing something good for somebody else. And technology does pose something of a risk to that in people's heads. So to healthcare professionals, actually the fact that that patient is over there somewhere on a screen isn't the core value of what they went into that profession to be able to do. And a lot of them talked about being able to touch somebody in order to show empathy or to show them that they care and that they're there for them. They actually said, I need them to know I'm there for them. And it's things like that, I think, that it's not a resistance to change. It's not about, it's actually that they're protecting the core things that they feel are important about the service. They want it to be the best thing for their patients that they can provide. And if we can convince them that they can have that relationship and that rapport with people through technology, then I think actually we'll start seeing more people buy into it.
I think I now understand why accountants are such big adopters, actually, of computer systems, because the loss of the human touch isn't a penalty, really.
Ooh.
Okay, sorry.
Don't you just love it when he sits on the fence?
We're going to invite you to contribute in a minute. So I'm just going to finish off by asking each of our panelists just a simple, two questions actually. First of all, just go back to the title we've got, balancing technology and a tender touch. So the first question is that a false dichotomy? Second question is a harder one. So if you were Vaughan Gething for the day, and you could do one thing to address some of the issues we've been talking about, what would you make sure you did before you went home that day? So first question, Kerry, let's start with you then. Is this a false dichotomy?
Yes.
Good.
And tell us what you really think.
I think we can probably guess why you're saying that, because you said it before. So the second question, the harder question, you're Vaughan Gething for the day. What are you going to do?
My priority for the day would be to adopt a de-identified data set, and you could, America have, under the HIPAA rules, they have a clearly laid out list of data which would make a de-identified set, which every hospital and healthcare group has to make available in order to improve healthcare, and that could be done in a day. You agree that data set, the governance is all set around it, and I was going to say, you just ask NWIS to roll it out, but there's the...
Great, thank you. That's great. So, Mike, false dichotomy, first question?
I would say it's not just one axis, there's two. So I'm kind of dodging the question a little bit. I think you can have technology, and without a lot of due diligence, technology will be dehumanizing by default. So I think you can see how it could be a continuum, but actually I think there's two angles on this. So yes, by default it would be, but instead of it being a line, it's like a cross. Imagine if you've got like that, and you can be down in the technology and dehumanizing area, and I think we should always strive to kind of push upwards so that it's about humanizing as well and enabling and providing opportunities. So that's the first question.
Super. Right, I'm now going to turn you into Vaughan Gething for
Vaughan
the day.
For the day.
What are you going to do?
Okay, two things, if that's all right.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, so the first thing is I would look into why it's less than 2% expenditure on IT, and I'd be having to ask my subordinates the very real questions of where can we find that 2 or 3% that are needed to actually properly invest in IT infrastructure. But I'd also then be saying, this is the second part really, where the value add is. And what I would prefer to do is to go to grassroots communities and say, okay, right, if you have the opportunity to have technology in your place, propose things for us to try in small. We can see if there's an evidence base, if they're efficacious, if they work, and then we can, those things that work, we can roll out. Those things that don't, we now have learned a lesson. So I'd actually get the people to participate in the development and the delivery and the evaluation of technologies, and let them grow, because it might be that they will only work in that small circumstance, but if they do and they provide some good service, then yes. So I would get my subordinates to be looking for cost saving or cost areas or improving funding to actually increase the infrastructure, and then saying to the grassroots people, you've got a project, you've got an idea, what do you want to do, what do you want to grow, because it could be from those things. We will self-grow much, much better systems than we will get by buying a product from a company, because diversity of supply is really, really important. We've all probably seen the stats about a health authority where they had to spend £1,500 to get their sanitizers filled up by a company because it had been privatized, instead of spending about half an hour going around at all of it, doing it themselves.
Good. Brilliant, thank you. And then Rachel, finally, so you had longest to think about this, so we're expecting big things from you. False dichotomy or not?
I think yes, it's a false dichotomy if it's managed appropriately. I think there's a risk, but I think certainly there's no reason why it needs to be.
Okay, great.
One or the other.
And then you're Vaughan Gething for the day. are you going to do?
I think my priority would be about improving the technology infrastructure across Wales, so broadband access, so that in trying to roll out certain technologies, we're making sure that actually it's our most vulnerable people who are most isolated that are being able to access the systems that we want them to access. And if I had a bit of money left over, I'd also fund, I think, more specific tech support within the NHS that could be there to better support healthcare professionals to manage these services and to roll them out.
Brilliant, brilliant. Can I, on your behalf, thank our panellists? So we're going to, we've got now, I think, best part of half an hour, so a good time. I'm going to invite people, if you can, to ask a reasonably succinct question. And then people will respond as they feel fit. So would you like just to say who you are and then ask the question?
Hi, I'm Nesta, I'm from the Welsh NHS Confederation. So one of the key recommendations in the parliamentary review was around public engagement. So all of you have talked about new technology, but how do we get patients involved? And one of the things is around the patient record. So one of the biggest barriers at the moment is if somebody goes to a hospital, how does their record go with them? So for example, my grandmother's just gone into hospital and a week later the GP's, you know, her record went with her. So why can't we empower the public by them having a patient record and having their information instead of going to the GP, asking for it? You know, sometimes it costs you to get information that is yours. So what are the barriers around, you know, the patients being more empowered and having their own record?
Brilliant question. Brilliant question. Who fancies having a go at that? Kerry?
Far as the technology has been rolling out in Wales, so I believe patients know best who are rolling out an AVMU at the moment, so that will allow patients to see their own data and share and give the permission to share it, whether in secondary care or wherever they are, people, and you can decide how much you share at that point. So that's a technology that is being rolled out in Wales, but it, you know, it's can be quicker. And NWIS are also talking about a minimum, I forgot what they call it, but like a minimum data that gets transferred automatically on a referral from primary to secondary care, or that secondary care can see, so key diagnoses, medications. But I mean, the discussions around that have been going on for years. You know, and that goes back to it, if I was a date, you know, just decide on it. You know, there's enough good examples around the UK to make that sort of decision. But I think in the meantime, patient knows best, have got a method of doing that. And that, I mean, like I say, as I develop any new technologies or algorithms, I go and talk to people in those areas and talk to patients and get a view on how they feel about it. And yeah.
Anybody else fancy having that? I mean, there are lots of fascinating examples. On the one hand, pregnant women have had their records for years, and the service hasn't collapsed. It's on the other hand, if you look at how difficult it's been to introduce a simple thing like, you know, copy consultants' letters that go to the GP, just copy it to the patient at the same time. So that would be a very simple, and I still don't think that's universal, is it? So even simple things like that, the health service seems to find really hard. Yeah. Good. Another question? We've got a microphone.
Hello, I'm Richard. I'm from Cwm Taf, so I'll watch what I say today. But one thing I noted, I had the opportunity to visit the research lab that IBM runs in New York when there wasn't IBM. And I was from the defense community at the time. And they said, you know, it used to be that we were driven by you guys in defense, but actually the consumer market drives us now. And I think that our health service today is built on a predicated idea of an information asymmetry that no longer exists and a power asymmetry that no longer exists. So when you said, you know, the most advanced piece of technology in my office was that phone, I hope you meant the one that you brought in your pocket, because there's more computing technology that my patients have and are bringing into the hospital. And my nurse today, who I saw standing by the window trying to download and do her banking, was holding more technology than I give her to do her job. So my question to you is, how can we unlock, you know, this asymmetry? And will we find ourselves outflanked in a few years? Because while we're struggling to catch up, actually the consumers are going to bypass us and head us off at the pass.
Great. Mike?
There's a stereotype, isn't there, that a patient goes into the doctor and says, well, I was reading on the internet and I've got all these symptoms. And I think sometimes, I mean, it is a stereotype, and the idea is that, oh, silly patients, they're reading on the internet, they're just hypochondriac, you know, they've got all these things. But actually, you know, sometimes patients, particularly if they have a known condition, can be much more expert on that condition. They know about those blind trials in the States, they know about this potential drug, you know, can I be put onto that drug trial, and so on. And you're right, I think they already have in some respects. But there are also naive users of that information as well. I mean, if anyone's a GP and has had somebody come in with a big printout from the internet of this thing, of course they could just be completely wrong. You know, they all got this symptom and that symptom and so on. I'm old enough now, I'm kind of in my 50s, where when I go to the GP, he generally kind of looks at me and goes, wear and tear. So, you know, I think we have to take more, I mean, this almost answers your question as well. We have to take much more responsibility for ourselves. The internet is a fantastic resource. I mean, I'm wearing this thing that every morning nags me, it's an Apple Watch, nags me to close my rings, to stand, to be stood up. I never have a problem with standing up, I'm a lecturer, I'm always standing up. Exercising, sometimes. Burning calories or footsteps and so on, it's kind of nagging me every day. And that is great, because it has, I definitely have an improvement there, and it also monitors my heart rate, and it also records all that data onto my mobile phone. And there is a case in America where the data on someone's mobile phone from their Fitbit was able to be used by, there's a few people nodding their heads, they've heard about this, by a coronary expert, so they could do an intervention straight away, rather than putting them on monitoring kit for hours to see if there was a problem. They could actually use this data that was there already. And in that respect, I think, you know, yes, if we've got this technology, and you're going to have one anyway, wouldn't it be great if we're just all given one for free? You know, and the nurses were given an iPhone or an Android phone, whatever it was, that was set up to be secure, which it can be, you know, so that you can have security on these devices. And you use that because you're carrying it around anyway. Use the technology your people have. Now, just a quick analogy. I used to work in Suffolk for a manor house, and they had a gardener there. And he was a wonderful guy. And he just looked at me once because he saw a big stretch of grass that had been like worn away by people's feet. And he said, Mike, build the path where they walk, not where you want them to walk, and then you won't get the grass worn away. So we have to actually, I think, listen and pay heed to the fact that consumers have got this technology and actually start to use it in our everyday lives, but also to take responsibility for our own health as much as for other people to do that.
Kerry?
It's a desk phone that I'm provided with. And, you know, I'm an early adopter. I've had an Alive Call, which is one of those little ECGs on my phone. I don't know if you've seen them. It's a little sticky thing on a phone that you just do an ECG from. You know, I've had one of those 4 years. I use it with my patients. But it doesn't, that's not the norm. And you're absolutely right. Things are overtaking. But why can't we use Skype and FaceTime? And the other, as you're talking about wearables, though, this is where I do start to worry about the inequalities, and we start to talk about wellness monitoring. And, you know, people in San Francisco say, it's great, you can bing onto your desktop as a doctor. It's like, I don't want any more information from well people. I want the communication and the access and the technology for my most vulnerable patients and to support them. So at the moment, that group isn't overtaken. You know, so that is a growing...
Left behind.
There is an info ghetto, isn't there? There are some people who are left behind. I mean, you say about broadband. My broadband in my valley is two cans and a piece of string. So given how much I use the internet, it can get quite annoying. But yes.
Let's take another question. The gentleman there.
I'm Harold Thimbleby. I've got an iWatch 2, and it is amazing. It's the most expensive watch I've ever had, and half the time it's useless because I have to keep charging it up.
Yeah.
And I look at it like this and it's rebooting. The question I want to ask is about evaluation. We can get excited by our watches, but we don't actually know whether they're any good, right? In the last century, everybody was excited by drugs, rightly, and then there was thalidomide, which caused chaos and regulation improved, and now you have to have randomized controlled trials and all sorts of things. This century, we've got IT. We've had all sorts of problems, like WannaCry, the Welsh system crashing last week. We've got a paediatrician who's been convicted of manslaughter, partly because of an IT failure. The National Programme for IT failed. Where is the evaluation for IT? It's the most expensive intervention the NHS has got, and nobody's evaluating it. Nobody really knows how good it is. All of the problems, Kerry, you mentioned, are failures of evaluation, and people adopting stuff without knowing how well it works. Yeah. And then you discover they don't talk to each other because nobody bothered to evaluate it. Mm. So why don't we do evaluation of IT and do it properly?
Let's take another question as well, and then the panel can... So perhaps the lady here would like to ask a question, then we'll go to the gentleman at the back.
My concern is what you've just touched on about the inequalities gap at the moment we know is widening in technology. Middle-class people with Fitbits are, well, easy access to services, but the people we're most worried about, and I suppose as a NHS, how are we going to consider them?
Right, so evaluation and inequity, and then we'll come to back to people at the back in a minute.
Yeah, no,
who would like to pick up either of those? Rachel?
I suppose one point I would perhaps make in terms of evaluation, in my experience, is that this stems back quite often to funding again, in the sense that a lot of the funding you see is for capital spends, and people are able to buy new equipment to set up new services. And often attached to that, there's an expectation that there's an evaluation, but with no money to pay for that evaluation. So often aligning research grants from universities with another grant that's come into in terms of capital spend can be difficult. And so what you then end up with is patchy evaluations or basic service evaluations that aren't really able to get into the depth of information that you need to pick up on some of those issues. And I'd completely agree with the inequalities point. I think the other thing, certainly in terms of these monitoring systems, that as a psychologist starts to worry me a little bit, is about how obsessive we have the potential to become over some of this data as well. And there's this real balance between what is useful for us to know and taking responsibility and becoming more autonomous in terms of our health, and also becoming overly focused on minute data and not living our lives in the end of it. So I think, I'm on the fence on that one.
The inequity bit in the rural context, I mean, I could see this playing either way. In a sense, this might reduce inequity because you're bringing in communities that are remote and so on, or, you know, the opposite could apply. What, any sense of that?
But certainly, yes, it has the potential for that in rural areas. And I think, for me, this is where the NHS leading on this is going to be so important, because then it's them determining who has certain access to certain equipment, as opposed to us just relying on individuals being able to afford to buy the things that they need to be able to access that. Now, I know that maybe is a bit of a utopia in the current climate, and I appreciate that. But I think there is a real risk that we're missing groups. Whereas if the NHS is driving it, there's potential for that to be dispersed into the areas that need it the most.
Mike.
Do you want to go for?
I think there's a lack of evaluation generally throughout the NHS. And not just research evaluation, good health service evaluation. So all the time as services are changing, and whenever I've run a service, I've always looked at not just your outcomes, but by, of course, by gender, by age group, and by inequalities, which is hardly ever done. It is not routinely done, but it should be routinely done. That's for everything, not just for health tech, but then as we bring in health tech, there's an opportunity for doing that as well.
So from personal experience, the cheaper IT is often not evaluated, and that often has the most wide-ranging effects. If you remember the machinery that's in the surgeon's theatre, You know, all that equipment would have had to have gone through very, very stringent evaluation. Well, one of my colleagues, Peter Plassman, actually has developed a 3D scanning piece of software called Mavis and hardware, which actually scans and makes a 3D model of open wounds, so it can actually get a good idea of the volume of and whether it's healing. That has had to gone through a lot of ethical and medical application approval, which is goes beyond just the idea of evaluating whether or not this PC I bought that's got Word on it is going to cause problems. So I think there is evaluation. From in the research on I've done on educational games and health apps, half to two thirds of the money that we set aside from grants, we put into evaluation and also participatory design. So the road safety app, the virtual reality app that we've got, we're working with 10 primary schools, over 100 pupils, and they were involved with their teachers right from the very beginning in terms of evaluating what the software should have in it, how it should work, looking at early prototypes, and they're going to be credited as co-developers of this app, so that those people were involved in the creation of that thing so it best fitted the kind of things that they needed and wanted. And in that respect, these are kind of pretty poor areas that we've gone to be involved in this. And that's where it kind of gets back to the inequities again. If you're putting money aside to properly evaluate, I mean, you might not agree that some of the medical technology has been evaluated, but anything where there's culpability, there has to be some kind of audit trail of evaluation. I would argue. I mean, one of the things we had to do was in English and Welsh in this road safety app say, have a little thing that says, this is supposed to make you aware of the risks of crossing a road, but you can't assume that you've learned how to cross the road just playing this virtual reality app. Because we didn't want someone to kind of do this and go, right, now, let's cross a road. Because all the cars stop in the virtual reality app. We don't have bump, blood splats, because they're for 7 to 9-year-olds. But of course, in the real world, cars don't just automatically always stop, and then you get a star taken off your score. So I think evaluation, if it's highlighted as being very important, and actually evaluating by the communities that maybe are often, you know, isolated, actually getting them involved in the development and the evaluation of technologies, I think is the way forward, because it's awareness raising as much as anything else. So communities that are isolated often aren't aware of opportunities or possibilities or technologies. Well, we'll find a grant and I'll work on something.
Okay, let's take, who's got the mic? Gentleman there. Yeah.
Mark Temple. I ought to declare an interest because I am or have been a BMA rep in the past. So the reason I'm going to ask this question, just in case anybody was interested in my question, which was, who pays when things go wrong? Because we know currently it's the doctor who's left holding the can. So he's the one that carries the can. He gets struck off, or she gets struck off, never works again, and is lambasted in the press if something goes wrong, even if it's the technology they've been given to work with against their wishes. They are still responsible for the patient's death.
Okay.
That has not been addressed yet by anybody. Please do so.
Thanks very much. And let's take another question as well.
Thank you. Hello, Jenny Sims. I am the press. I'm a medical journalist. I write one of the things I write for is a medtech engine website, and I've written about most of the issues today. I haven't written about the issue just suggested, or the one that's, I think, one of the most important in the room. Kicked off early on today with Kerry, really, why does Fawn Gething not get it? What, you know what needs to be done. Why really? Can you not spell it out? What really needs to be done? Why isn't it being done?
Super. And there's a gentleman there in the middle at the back who's got his hand in the air, who's been very patient.
I think my question might be related to the last question.
Just say who you are.
Right. I'm Ian McKinley. I'm a member of the IWA. I'm not involved professionally in the subject matter tonight. I'm interested in other things, and I can see, obviously, a lot of overlap, you know, problems that are common elsewhere. She mentioned Vaughan Gething. Before I get on to my comment, I'd like to ask a question of everybody here. I don't think there's any AMs in the room here, but my question is this. Are there any civil servant members of the Welsh Government here to take feedback from this event back to the likes of Vaughan Gething?
Anybody prepared to own up?
So there's a measure of it. You started off this evening by talking about a political problem to the problems, or the politics were a problem in dealing with the subject matter of tonight. Do you remember you started off by referring to something there? No, I'm not referring.
Carry on anyway. Yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, the point is that I think the Assembly members in general, on subjects which I feel as I do know about, which isn't the subject here tonight, their ignorance is appalling. And there are such things as, for example, and I dare say you have one that will relate to the subject matter tonight, is the cross-party group on X, Y or Z. Are people in this room familiar with the appropriate cross-party group in the Assembly that would deal with this matter? Have anybody been along to it? Do they have the same sort of experiences I have when I go along to the cross-party group on sustainable energy, for example? And apart from Clare Griffiths, who's the chair of that particular cross-party group, you're lucky if you see other Assembly members there. There may well be some staff from the relevant departments, but the whole purpose of having a cross-party group is so that specialists in various relevant areas can give talks and other people can attend, and they can learn things from it. And frankly, they don't go along to learn from it. The last one, which is, I think, in September, if you look at the minutes, there are about four AMs that are supposed to be there, including former director of the IWA, Lee Waters was one of those that's listed. But, you know, I didn't even see him there. So these people, it may well be they're very busy, and so they've only got a few minutes to pop in, and that's what they do. But it defeats the object of it. I think you're getting my point. There's nobody here tonight from the Welsh Government, even if it's a civil servant in the department that's relevant, to take back the comments that are made tonight. Thank you.
So, thank you. That's very, so, in a sense, if I can join those two. So, the first question is about culpability and responsibility in the medico-legal context. The second question is, if I can pull those two together, is how do we inform, cajole, persuade the political class, if I can call them that, to embrace some of these issues and remove some of the obstacles? There we are. There's a couple of... couple of good questions. Kerry, do you want to pick up either or both of those?
So in answer to Mark's question, so this is referring to the issue that we heard about earlier about the paediatrician, I presume, which the BMA are very active. It's a bit of it, of course. I wonder if it's partly going back to this question of what is health tech and its evaluation and everything else, because if we prescribe the wrong thing, but there's clear guidance, if we prescribe off-licence, then it's our culpability. You know, if I haven't followed the BNF, if I haven't followed like a guidance with it for medicines, and perhaps that could be applied to health tech. We don't have that sort of guidance, and we don't have, so therefore it all comes back to me as a professional. So it does link to a lot of those other issues. And as we're aware, we don't have the same idea about culpability as airline pilot. You know, we don't look at the systems. We don't. We claim to, but we still don't in healthcare. It still comes back to us individuals. Going back to what we can do to influence, and do they know? I got one question asked. You know, a written question to say how many of the SBRI projects. So, you know, the Small Business Research Initiative. So there. There's so many projects that have worked and have been effective in Wales, and they are not being adopted. And so I asked about SBRI a couple of years ago, and we were talking today a group of companies saying, well, perhaps we should start this process again, start asking some written questions. We were talking about getting some of the key researchers, the AMs probably wouldn't come along, but you know, some of the key civil servants, and we put forward all our case stories about what's happening, because do they know that there's all what's going on out there and what a difference it could make? And I suspect not. And journalists, you've got, I guess, a role in all of that as well. We all have.
Mike?
Could we answer the question? Because you had a significant period of time where you made your position clear, and I don't think it was necessarily particularly relevant to tonight's discussion. Firstly, I think to address the point of why isn't things being done, isn't it dreadful that being healthy is a political act? So the idea of being healthy is a political act. It's almost like, I'm going to choose to be healthy. Or I'm going to have my choices of being healthy taken away from me. And I think it's such a shame it is a political act. But to come back to Mark's question about culpability, all the courses we run at University of South Wales in computing are accredited by the British Computer Society. Even if that wasn't the case, and they actually do insist on this, we have what we call LSEPI, legal, social, ethical elements that we have to put into our courses. I've run case studies, mock trials, based on a lovely book called The Case of the Killer Robot, which all the computing students will have to be aware of. All their final year projects, a lot of the first and second year and third year coursework have to incorporate LSLP issues. What are the ethical, social constraints? What are the professional constraints upon them? So anyone who's graduating with a computer science degree or computer games development degree or information security degree, they all have, all the way through, embedded within all the coursework that they do, all the assessments that they do, this idea of ethical and professional behaviour and conduct. And I think that's extremely important. I mean, even if it wasn't for the BCS really pushing and insisting, British Computer Society, I beg your pardon, even if it wasn't for them really, really pushing that, as professionals, we want our programmers, who could be the people who are responsible for the autonomous car killing that bus queue. There have been deaths in autonomous vehicles, and the issue then was, who was culpable? Was it the hardware manufacturer? Was it the software person? Was it the person running the car, or the person who maintained it poorly? And that's where the case of the killer robot is a wonderful example, because it actually addresses all the different areas of risk of concern. And I think it is important that we actually engage in these ethical debates about what technology, who is responsible for technology when it's introduced. Yeah.
Did you want to come in on those, or should we take? We've probably got time for one more question, unless.
No, I have nothing burning.
Grant, good. So I think we've probably got time for one more question. Sorry, we're running out of time.
I'm Hugh Irwin. I'm a director of a consultancy which promotes strengths-based approaches in health and social care. My question was, there was a kind of a joke made about accountants earlier on, which is interesting, but there's actually I'm not an accountant, it's okay, you haven't offended me. But there was actually something serious in that. And I had a history of working in housing, okay, and for many years now, social housing organisations have been talking about digital by default. Everything's by default. It takes what the individual human need out of the equation. And somebody mentioned earlier on about how healthcare professionals or others, you know, worry about not being able to, you know, touch the individual and, you know, I think it was yourself, let them know that they're there for them. But what really should be happening is because some people don't need that. Mm. You know, we need to be asking people, actually, this technology is available. We can use this in the way that suits you, rather than, because I think what we always do is we try and push stuff out and to become a default position. But your introverts and your extroverts are all different, and they all need different things. So your accountants probably wouldn't need to have the touchy feely service, and that's fine, isn't it? So let's use the resources a lot more efficiently for those who actually need it in a different way. So that was the only point.
So turn that into a question for us.
We're
programmed to answer questions.
So the question is how does technology how can it be used for how can the person still use, how can be individual choice that drives how technology is used, as opposed to having a default position on it?
Brilliant. And that beautifully brings us back to our question as well. That's a masterful question. Who wants to have a go at that? Rachel?
I think that's really interesting, in the sense that, yes, we saw that, and actually patients really didn't experience that. They certainly spoke about building great relationships with the healthcare professionals that they were remote to, feeling that they completely got them from that. And in one of the projects, it was particularly interesting that people that we recruited commented that they wouldn't have, but this was to run group psychotherapy for patients who were immune suppressed. So they all individually linked from home to a psychotherapist and had group art therapy. And out of those people, I think there was only one person who said they would have gone to a face-to-face group. The others all said, I only did this because it was remote and I felt I could shut off from it if it wasn't for me. So actually there's another group of people who actually we have potential to access who don't want the current system of that touchy-feely kind of approach. It's not for everybody, and I don't think anybody would argue that this is a solution to never needing people, but I think there are a group of people actually who don't need that.
It goes back to my first point of being patient-centred, doesn't it, and offering choices. And my current system of having 20 calls from 8:30 every 5 minutes, sort of the call is a default, which isn't ideal. They can have a face-to-face. But every patient, I'll say, do you want to come in and see me? Or, you know, shall I call you back next week? Or so it's trying to put those choices into place. And actually, a lot of people go, no, that's fine. You know, that sorted it out. And but it's giving those choices.
And Mike?
Being involved from the very beginning in the development, I think, is one of the ways forward. I think I'm very, very keen on participatory design. I think as a computer scientist or knowledge engineer, it's drilled in that these things have to serve people. And that's why in my profession, we are always thinking about the system, which is the existing human system, maybe with paper, maybe without, maybe communicating verbally, and how we can improve parts of that using technology and recognizing that there is a barrier and there is a boundary point where you can have hybrid behavior. And I think if that's done properly and effectively, and I think NWIS is pretty good, in comparison with other services, then we involve, with public engagement, I think was mentioned earlier, we involve patients and ask their opinions on things, and they feel valued and that they're actually physically contributing, properly contributing to the development of these services, then they will have more confidence in that service, and that then it will be taken up.
So I just want to say, Rachel, I know you said, I don't think anybody would suggest that about not having any contact. Here in Wales, a couple of years ago, there was a lady from IBM, which when you were talking about IBM earlier, it reminded me, and I think she was head of the Internet of Everything for the UK or something, I can't remember her name, but she was talking about this vision of no humans being able, having to go out to these rural patients. And I was sitting there thinking, oh my goodness. So there are people out there who really do believe in that sort of world, unfortunately. Mm. And of course, the human touch to some people is incredibly healing. We don't want to lose that.
But it's a limited supply. I mean, that's the thing, is it's in limited supply. So if a lot of services and a lot of people's interactions can be what they prefer, then hopefully we'll open up. Technology ideally should open up to allow the human element to be where that needs to be in the system.
And what I've started calling, we have complementary therapy, is complementary technology.
Yes,
so it adds to our
great title. Yeah.
That's a brilliant, brilliant point on which to end.
Complementary technology.
Thank you for your superb questions, which have provoked a whole new richness to this discussion. So thank you all for that. And perhaps I can ask you to thank once again our three panellists for, what was the phrase, lending their expertise to us.
Can we have it back now? and thanks to our wonderful chair as well.
I'm from Cardiff University and I'm not going to keep you from the wine for at all long, but I did just want to say a proper thank you to all the panel and to the chair stroke panel. And when we decided to partner with the IWA, we always knew that it meant we could get fantastic speakers on these panels, and I think tonight it's just been such a good evidence of that. I mean, what you've all brought is your evidence-based experience from your research, your personal experiences and your professional experiences, and certainly sitting in the audience I found it enlightening. And I'd also like to
thank the audience for such a range of intelligent and thoughtful questions from such a wide range of people as well. I hope very much you'll continue to look out for these events that we're organising with the IWA and to come to them in the future.